to the people of Florida, and we have delivered on those promises. And so today, after 4 years, the people have delivered their verdict. Freedom is here to stay.
Supporters of Ron DeSantis Tuesday night chanting 2 more years after the Florida governor crushed his Democratic opponent, former governor Charlie Crist, by nearly 20 points. Yeah, DeSantis did win a 4-year term, but his supporters want him to pursue the Republican nomination for president in 2 years. One obstacle, though, could be his fellow Floridian, former President Donald Trump, who's been teasing his own reelection bid for months and chummed the waters this week at a rally in Dayton, Ohio.
I'm going to be making a very big announcement on Tuesday, November 15th, at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida.
Although he may now delay that announcement, DeSantis's huge win, along with the fact that many Trump-backed candidates lost Tuesday, are fueling speculation that Trump may not be the heir apparent. But would DeSantis's red tsunami in Florida translate to the national stage? And can he sway diehard MAGA voters to abandon Trump? Dave Seminara is here now to talk about DeSantis, Florida, and the Republican Party. He's a conservative writer based in St. Petersburg who's been writing about this for The Wall Street Journal and others. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Okay, well, we heard some ominous music there at that Trump rally. I want to play a little bit more underneath this ad. The DeSantis campaign ran in the final days of his reelection bid.
And on the 8th day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a protector. So God made a fighter. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, kiss his family.
Okay, so that goes on for a while, and it obviously has big Christian overtones. And, you know, one of the biggest selling points of DeSantis is that he's not Trump and doesn't have the same kind of baggage. But what about this idea, the sort of cult of personality that he's putting forth in that ad? How do you square that?
So, no, I think that DeSantis is sort of Trump's polar opposite in this regard, right? So especially since 2020, especially since he lost in 2020, Donald Trump's whole sideshow has all been about himself. But as far as Ron DeSantis goes, we know very little about him as a person. He's always talking about policy. He's always talking about legislation. He doesn't talk about himself. I mean, he actually, you know, Trump has appealed to working class voters, but actually Ron DeSantis is a working class guy. I just traveled to his neighborhood where he grew up. His parents still live there. But it's not something he talks about. He doesn't advertise that. I was tasked with writing a story about his childhood and his formative experiences in Dunedin, which is a town half hour away from where I lived. And it was actually quite a struggle because he's not a person who talks about himself that often. So I don't think that DeSantis is a cult of personality type character at all. He's sort of the opposite of Trump in that regard.
So what was that ad about then?
I have no idea. I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Couldn't tell you. I don't know anything about it. Haven't heard
his
it.
His wife tweeted it.
Knowing him well, you know, over the in writing about him many times and having, you know, digging into his childhood and even trying to find statements about growing up in Dunedin and things of that nature, he doesn't often talk about himself. If you listen to his speeches and such like that, he's not a person who talks about himself. So I don't know anything about the ad. Haven't heard of it. Haven't heard it before. But generally, it's not his approach. He's not a narcissist in the same way that Donald Trump is.
So do you think he will run for president?
Absolutely. No question in my mind. You know, I had some doubts about that a few months ago. But, in the debates against Crist repeatedly was hectoring him about committing to serving for 4 years. And he refused to do so. So to me, that was a very, very clear indication that he's ready to fight Trump.
So you think that he would be willing to stomach all of what Trump would eventually assuredly dish out if Trump does run again? He started it with the nickname De Sanctimonious already.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think he's ready for this fight. In fact, I think he's spoiling for it. And he's bit his tongue. He hasn't responded to any of Trump's insults or barbs. But I think that he's actually looking forward to meeting Trump in a debate and to standing on a podium and being able to talk policy and to be able to make the case. I think he's got a very clear case to make. Listen, Trump has been the savior of the Democratic Party. But I think now a lot of Republicans are looking at DeSantis to be the savior of the Republican one. And I think that DeSantis has a clear case to make that, hey, do you want to win in 2024 or do you want to go down with a sinking ship? And I think, look, Republicans were expecting this big red wave that didn't materialize. And they're looking around right now and thinking, huh, do we want to lose again in 2024 or do we want to do something different?
Well, let's talk about how he rose to what we saw on Tuesday night, because when he first ran in 2018, not so long ago, he barely won. He won by 32,000 votes. Cut to this week, he wins by a crushing margin, more than a million votes. So how was he able to do that?
Right. And that's it's a great contrast to when you look at what Donald Trump did. So Donald Trump, actually, people got more and more sick of him after 4 years. Right. So he got a certain percent. He lost the popular vote by, I believe, 2% in 2016. He lost it by almost 5% in 2020. Here in Florida, it was sort of the opposite, sort of like the more we got to know Ron DeSantis, the more people here in Florida liked him. He put together, sort of an amazing coalition. And I think it was mostly from competent governance, to be honest with you. People like the way things have gone here. We just had a major hurricane here, Hurricane Ian, and the response to it was, by all measures, quite competent. It's a state where we have a low tax burden, but at the same time, we have a big budget surplus. So I think generally people like the way things that have run. I think that the one difference between DeSantis and Republicans nationally, at least in recent elections, Republicans have done very poorly with the female vote. And I think that Ron DeSantis turned that around by focusing on education issues. I think that things like the big one was keeping schools open during the pandemic. I mean, that was absolutely massive, especially for, from working mothers here in Florida. That was huge. I think also focusing on the curriculum, focusing on reading, writing, and arithmetic and not anything else in the classroom was big. And I think the biggest one, perhaps, aside from keeping schools open, is the expanding school choice option for moms here. So right. I think, focusing on education was for him a really good ticket of doing better with the female vote.
Okay, but he also plays into culture warrior stuff, and it does come down to a lot of what's being taught in the classroom. He has campaigned vigorously against what he calls this so-called woke agenda. I want to play another clip of tape from his victory speech Tuesday night.
States and cities governed by leftist politicians have seen crime skyrocket. They've seen their taxpayers abused. They've seen medical authoritarianism imposed, and they've seen American principles discarded. The woke agenda has caused millions of Americans to leave these jurisdictions for greener pastures.
All right, so there he is, really just openly embracing the culture warrior part of his policies. He, of course, has led the charge on the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. He took on Disney. He was talking about COVID there. He's taken on Anthony Fauci. He has signed the Stop Woke Act. I think that's what it's called, limiting how much of racism can be taught in schools or at workplaces. And so why has he just openly embraced this idea of himself as a culture warrior when it can be so divisive and, frankly, hurtful to some communities?
Well, here in Florida, it really hasn't been divisive. As you can see, you don't win an election in a purple state like Florida or a state that's so evenly divided by 20 points by being a divider. So I think that you have to separate fact from fiction. The media has been, since Donald Trump lost in 2020, has been looking for a new Republican villain. And he's played the role of this. And there's been a tremendous amount of disinformation regarding, like what you just called the Don't Say Gay bill, for example. I mean, the media told us that people were literally not allowed to say they were gay in classes or talk to their teachers about being gay, which is completely false. And I think that people here in Florida were smart enough to separate fact from fiction and to determine that basically a lot of what the media told us was not correct. And so, you don't win by 20 points by being a divider. So that's really not how he's perceived here.
Right, I guess. But by demonizing gay people as...
He didn't demonize gay people. He never did that. So I'm going to dispute that characterization. How did he demonize gay people?
Well, when you can't say you... When you tell people you can't talk about being gay in the classroom...
No, that's not what the legislation says. See, that's part of the misinformation. It's what the legislation says is no classroom instruction on gender studies and gender ideology. That does not mean that a teacher... So that it's not part of the curriculum. That's the focus of it. And so that's not demonizing anyone. What that's saying is that classroom instruction should focus on basic subjects, reading, writing, arithmetic, et cetera. And that's popular here in Florida. Mm-hmm. Might not be popular in California, but it's popular here. And especially with Hispanics,
clearly.
who won, you know, he won Miami-Dade County by 12 points. And so we found that Hispanics here in Florida are not woke. They want their children to go to schools and to learn the basics.
Okay. So talk a bit about as well when you're talking about the Latino vote and the fact that we talked about this yesterday on the program as well, that Democrats really did not show up in terms of putting money into the state this cycle or in terms of registering Democrats and so or anybody to be in the Democratic Party, whereas the Republicans really had a strong ground game. Why have the Democrats basically ceded Florida to the Republicans?
Because I think, you know, there's just the reality of the situation, right? So when you see polls where your man is down 15 points, what's the point of, you know, pouring money into a sinking ship when you've got Pennsylvania, you've got Nevada, you know, you have all of these swing states. So yeah, I mean, I guess the Democrats have given up on the state, except for, I guess, Gavin Newsom, who ran ads here. We were all surprised to see encouraging us to move to California, which we all thought were kind of quite hilarious, to be honest, because people, we see California plates here in Florida a lot. You know, I've got a friend who is a realtor here, and she says California is one of the, you know, one of the most common states people are coming here from. So we thought that was quite interesting.
So do you expect DeSantis to win the Republican nomination in 2 years?
Yes, I do. And I expect him to be our next president, too.
All right. Well, Dave Seminara, conservative writer based in St. Petersburg, Florida. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Coming up, Weird Al Yankovic and Daniel Radcliffe are here to talk about their new fake biopic. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you're a Gen Xer, you probably remember seeing the Weird Al video for Eat It on MTV.
Get yourself an egg and beat it. Have some more chicken. Have some more pie. It doesn't matter if it's boiled or fried. Just eat it. Just eat it. Just eat it.
His 1984 spoof of the Michael Jackson hit Beat It sold 500,000 copies and launched a career that has kept fans laughing ever since. It just doesn't get old, that song. Well, a new movie tells the origin story of Weird Al Yankovic. Well, the Weird Al version of Weird Al's life. In other words, it's a parody.
Do I know you?
Madonna, I was wondering if you were going to do a parody of my song, Like a Virgin.
I'm curious, is that song autobiographical?
Yes. Except for the fact that I've had a lot of sex.
Name one creative genius that doesn't have a checkered past involving alcohol.
That's the medicine.
And drugs.
Weird, the Al Yankovic story, just debuted on the Roku channel. It stars Daniel Radcliffe as Weird Al. He is, of course, best known as starring in the 8 Harry Potter movies. Radcliffe was not even born when Eat It was released, but both are here now. Welcome, Weird Al and Dan Radcliffe. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Yeah, very well. Thank you for having us.
Wow, you sound so similar. I know one is British and one is not.
We won't say who.
Okay. Okay, Al, did you intend to do a parody biopic of your life? Because you wrote this as well, right?
Yeah, that was always the intention, because an actual true biopic wouldn't be that interesting. I haven't had a very dramatic life full of scandal and controversy. And we figured it should follow the same formula as every single other Hollywood music biopic. So we had a troubled childhood and a lot of things going on that you know, maybe are exaggerated or perhaps more likely fabricated from scratch.
Is there any truth to any of it?
Yeah, I mean, there's several things in the movie that actually happened. I did, in fact, start taking accordion lessons because of a door-to-door salesman. I did record my first single, My Bologna, in a public restroom. And there was such a thing as the Yankovic bump, meaning that whenever I do a parody, the original artist actually has a spike in sales. So, I mean, there are several things in the movie which are true or rooted in reality, but then we, again, exaggerate them or go in a whole different direction.
So you didn't have a relationship with Madonna?
Not as such. I mean, I talked to her for 45 seconds in 1985. So if that's a relationship, I don't know what you're considering a relationship, really.
Well, maybe it is. I don't know. So, Daniel, how much did you know about Weird Al before you signed on to this?
So when my girlfriend and I started dating 10 years ago, that's when my true education in Weird Al kind of began. I knew sort of the biggest hits probably before that. But I didn't have the sort of encyclopedic knowledge that Aaron's family had. And so, yeah, Al kind of became the soundtrack to Christmas, even though, as you point out the other night, you only really have two Christmas songs, was the soundtrack to Christmas and road trips and things like that. So it's just been a steady progression of learning and loving more and more and more of Al's work. So that by the time I got, you know, to read this script and have this offer come through, I was sort of pretty well prepared for it. I mean, I really was more than aware of who Al was. I was a fan at that point. So it was, you know, made it intimidating, but very exciting to take on.
Why intimidating?
Well, I've played real people before, but I've never played somebody that I am like an active fan of while they are also there and part of the process. That's a pretty unusual situation. But I ended up in the best version of that situation because it was Al, and thankfully Al is incredibly like supportive and kind and like encouraging of both my performance and of you know, the movie as a whole. So it made the intimidation factor lessened as we went on.
And Al, were you intimidated by Daniel?
Daniel, I always kind of felt like we were kindred spirits. So he felt like an immediate friend. So even though I'm highly respectful of his work and his his being an icon, I don't think we were like in awe of each other. We just kind of like got on immediately well with each other just because we just felt like, you know, we were just two huge nerds doing what we love to do.
Okay, so Daniel, you wear a crazy wig, you have a mustache, you strap on an accordion. How else do you go about trying to be Weird Al?
You've really cracked the first three. There's also, for me, there's the costume and the hair and makeup is a very big part of it. I think the thing that was most helpful, you know, it's not always the way I go about things, but sometimes it can be helpful to sort of identify character traits that you do feel like you have in common or that, you know. And with this, I do think there's Al operates in, to the way I see it, a space that's sort of between the incredibly sweet and kind and earnest and the just psychotically unhinged and deranged. And that's really, if I could spend my entire life working in that sort of area, that would be ideal. I feel like that was just the thing that I was going for with the character, is trying to capture both that earnest sweetness, but also later on, as the character becomes less like real Al, to sort of feral, unhinged a quality that he has to have.
Is there anything, Al, in you that's feral and unhinged in real life?
There is, but I'm not letting anybody know about it. It's my personal secret.
I'm wondering also, have you ever thought about doing a parody of Harry Potter movies or anything like that?
You know, I actually was considering a Harry Potter parody song, like, gosh, I don't know, a couple of decades ago. I made what was probably a mistake, and I contacted, I guess it was Warner Brothers Pictures, just to say, hey, would you mind if I did a Harry Potter parody? And we either never got a response or they said, no, because, you know, when you deal with a major corporation and a franchise, there are so many people that can say no, and they usually do. So I kind of learned my lesson from that.
Oh, so have you ever done a parody and then been told to pull it?
No,
as a parody?
I always get permission ahead of time so that I will never find myself in that scenario, hopefully. So everybody knows going into it what I'm doing. And most people actually look at it as an homage, and they're flattered by the parody. But no, yeah, everybody knows ahead of time, and hopefully nobody gets upset.
Was there one that you really, really wanted to do, but you weren't allowed to?
Well, famously, Prince never let me do any of his songs. He was always very protective of his music, and I can understand that. And I had half a dozen or so ideas that I pitched him, and he just never was into it. So that was the one that got away.
Well, I think, you know, parody aside, in this movie, I really do want to know how you got into this. How did this become your life's work?
Well, it did, in fact, start with Dr. Demento. Dr. Demento had a radio show starting in the early 70s, and he played all sorts of crazy music on the radio, like Spike Jones and Tom Lehrer and Alan Sherman, Stan Freberg. And I was being exposed to these people for the first time in my life, because all those people were basically, you know, years before my time. And I started sending them tapes in the mail that I recorded in my bedroom, just me and my accordion, you know, recording into a cheesy little cassette tape recorder. And he would play my stuff on the radio. I mean, this is decades before YouTube or any kind of social media. So there wasn't any kind of outlet for a weird kid making stupid songs. And he would play my unprofessional, amateurish tapes on the radio. And that, you know, that made my brain explode. I couldn't believe, like, I was getting played on the radio. And that encouraged me to just keep doing it. And I just never got tired of it.
That's amazing. I mean, it really is kind of a, I don't know, rags to riches or a real American story.
It's a strange story. I mean, you know, I am the least likely person to achieve fame, particularly, you know, a fame that's lasted as long as it has so far.
Why do you think it has lasted as long as it has? There was a huge New York Times essay about how you were a salve during the COVID lockdowns.
You know, I don't know. I mean, luck, I guess, enters into it. Also, I surround myself with very talented people. I've had the same band since the early 80s. They've been with me for 40 years, and they're some of the best musicians in the world. I tend to you know, keep people close to me, and I'm loyal to them, and they're loyal to me. And, you know, there's probably a modicum of talent in there somewhere, but I think it's mostly me faking it and surrounding myself with people that know better.
Well, Daniel, I'm wondering how it felt for you trying to kind of embody that whole unlikely story and what you make of it, what you make of the fact that Weird Al is really an icon and an unlikely icon. And here you are.
You know, I will slightly dispute unlikely. I get what, you know. Yes, an accordion. There's a lot about Al that seems at first unlikely, but I feel like Al is also a very naturally self-effacing, humble person. And
yeah.
I don't know. I think it's also it's not just luck. Like, it's an enormous amount of talent and hard work from obviously the band as well, but from Al. And you know, I was lucky enough to see Al in concert the other night, and watching him live, seeing the breadth of what he can do as a performer and a vocalist is so cool. and definitely something that I feel like people can overlook sometimes, or not everyone does. Some people are very, very aware. Anyone who's seen you live is very aware. That's why it was intimidating to play him in a way, because I am also so aware of what he means to so many people. And while this film is not a one-to-one recreation of Al and his life, it's definitely something that I hope captures and sort of honors his spirit in a way. And it does, as we've talked about on this press tour, it's not a film that you should go into expecting to take a message or a moral away from, but there is something deeply, I think, sweet and true in there about embracing your own weirdness and being proud of who you are. That if there is a message to the film, then that is it.
Which is the message of Harry Potter, too.
I guess. Yes, exactly. You know what? I've been essentially making one film my entire life. It's the message of Swiss Army Man as well. It's the message of a lot of miracle workers. Like, this is something that I think, I genuinely think is a great theme, and probably that is why it comes up in a lot of my stuff. Maybe this movie is a Harry Potter parody, you know? This is just the ninth Harry Potter in the world. Under the franchise.
Yeah. I know. Well, it does kind of see that. I mean, do you, I don't know, are you self-conscious in that sense, Daniel, that people look at you and they think, oh, Harry Potter, or Harry Potter doing something else, Harry Potter, you know, playing another kind of oddball character.
No, not really. I mean, that's the thing. I feel like there are probably some people who do see that. And there are also a lot who don't. I feel like, I think very soon after finishing Potter, I accepted that, you know, the thing that will be, the Harry Potter is going to be the first line of my epitaph. And it doesn't matter what I do for the rest of my life, that will always be the case. And I feel like as soon as you accept that, then you can go, like, okay, well, then that doesn't really matter. So what else are you going to do? You know, so yeah, I don't, people, I'm sure some people do just see me as Harry, but enough people now see me as somebody who wants to make other choices that it's certainly not holding me back from doing what I want to do.
Do you have a favorite Weird Al song?
I mean, I have several. They change a lot. But I love Bob. I love the lyrics to it.
Rise to vote, sir. Do geese see God? Do nine-man interpret? Nine-man I nod. Rats live on no evil star. Won't lovers revolt
and,
now.
And Al, do you have a favorite Weird Al song?
I don't. When people ask me about it, I usually say White and Nerdy.
They see me mowing my front lawn. I know they're all thinking I'm so white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
Think I'm just too white and nerdy.
Can't you see I'm white and nerdy? Look at me, I'm white and nerdy.
I didn't have to do any research for that. My whole life has been research.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today. It's been great talking
with you.
No worries. Thank you so much.
Weird, the Al Yankovic story, is currently streaming exclusively on the Roku channel. And we've been speaking with Weird Al Yankovic and Daniel Radcliffe, who plays him in the quote-unquote biopic.
Ooh, a little hungry one, hungry one. Open up a package of my Bologna. Ooh, I think the toast is done, the toast is done. Top it with a little of my Bologna. Never gonna stop, eat it up. Such a tasty snack, I always eat too much. And throw up, but also me back to my, yeah, yeah. Woo! My Bologna.
Coming up, we have other movies you can check out. We'll have your weekend film reviews, including Wakanda Forever.
Can you be both disappointed yet thrilled at the same time? That's the feeling I was left with.
That's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Time now for film reviews. This week, a much-anticipated Black Panther sequel is here. And here to talk about that and other new movies, we have Katie Walsh. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service, the Los Angeles Times, and The Wrap. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Madeline.
Also, Sean Edwards is here. He is film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. Okay, first up, The Fabelmans. This is directed by Steven Spielberg, co-written by Spielberg and Tony Kushner, and it stars Michelle Williams, Gabriel LaBelle, and Paul Dano.
In this family, it's the scientists versus the artists. Sammy's on my team, takes after me.
What kind of movie are we going to make?
All right, Katie, this is a semi-autobiographical film about Spielberg as a young boy, as he finds his life's calling after his parents take him to see a Cecil B. DeMille movie, The Greatest Show on Earth, and his mom is supportive of him pursuing his dreams. His dad, of course, is not. What else should we know about this?
This is a story of Steven Spielberg learning, you know, it's his memoir of becoming a filmmaker, of discovering his calling, but it's also a story about him reckoning with his parents' relationship. And it's a very gracious film. There's a lot of warmth and loving feelings towards his family. I wouldn't say that there's this really strong struggle between the artist and the scientist and the, you know, his dad is not supportive. It's a little bit more nuanced and complicated than that. And I think because it comes from real life, they are able to be so complex and so real and authentic. And one would think that this maybe would be a little bit maudlin, But this film is so warm and lovely and funny and playful and mischievous. There's like a real sense of play to the filmmaking. And it just reminds us of why we fell in love with the movies. And it shows us how much Spielberg is still just a kid having fun making movies.
Okay, Sean, this is the man who brought us Jaws, of course, and dinosaurs and aliens and all sorts of big monsters. E.T., for example. I guess E.T. is not a monster. But anyway, what are your thoughts on this form of filmmaking from him?
Well, no, you'll get no argument from me that Steven Spielberg is one of the greatest directors of all time. He just doesn't direct greatness all of the time. A perfect example of that is The Fabelmans. I mean, yeah, sure, it's a depiction of his childhood and him as a teenager and how he came to fall in love with the filmmaking process and the power of cinema. And yes, the film is often smart, it's poignant, painful at times, but it's also dull. It's a bit bloated, a bit self-indulgent, but thankfully, Michelle Williams and Paul Dano add some serious gravitas who portray Steven Spielberg's conflicted parents. I mean, both performances are nuanced and really well measured. The problem is not much really happens. I mean, sure, it's a terrific love letter to cinema and what inspired Steven Spielberg to become one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. But there just isn't much tension. There's not a lot of excitement, nor are there any obstacles. I mean, it's sort of like just this one long piece of cinematic poetry. It often gets a bit preachy in certain spots. And like the middle part of the film all of a sudden felt like I was watching a after school special. But craftsmanship's in full display. I just wish the storytelling were stronger and more consistent. I mean, is The Fabelmans a timeless classic that ranks as one of Steven Spielberg's best? I would begrudgingly say yes, but I will also say I was expecting much more.
All right. The Fabelmans in theaters in wide release beginning today. Next up, we have Sam and Kate. This is really a family affair. It stars Dustin Hoffman and Sissy Spacek, and they have a love interest. But it also stars their real life children, Jake Hoffman and Skylar Frisk. And they also have a little bit of a flirtation happening. So let's listen to the trailer.
I was wondering if I could call you. We could hang out.
I'm not really dating right now.
Perfect, because I'm not dating anybody right now.
If you want to get a girl like that, you got to start acting like a man. You're working at the chocolate factory. You're drawing pictures. Not to mention the fact that you're still living under my roof.
Okay, you know what you need?
What?
You need to get laid.
Get out of here. All right. We'll get
these hearts beating. It's been a long time since I've been out like this. Don't need a
rhyme or reason. Why didn't you tell me you went on a date with Tina?
Didn't know I had to.
My mom, she would call herself collector.
She's a beautiful woman.
Okay, Sean, so talk about this. You've got the real life kids of the real life actors playing their fictional kids. Do you forget that they're actually the real life parent and child in this or not?
Never for a second. The problem is because the kids look so much like the parents. It's almost virtually impossible to be like, that's not Dustin Hoffman's son. That's not Sissy Spacek's daughter. Yeah, this is a classic display of nepotism. But anyway, I mean, The thing with this movie is it actually should have started with a long time ago in a galaxy far away, because Sam and Kate pretty much represents a contemporary version of Americana that many people have been searching for but haven't really realized that it never really existed. Now, Dustin Hoffman portrays this sort of cantankerous old man who's recently dealing with the death of his wife. So he's going through some struggles. His son, played by his real-life son, has moved back in town to sort of help him cope with his grief and the struggles of his new life. Just so happens the son falls in love with a woman who runs a small bookstore. Apparently, that's a really easy thing to do in movies. As you can see, it's got all the stereotypical sort of like rom-com elements, because she's super guarded and she doesn't like him at first. And she's got some secrets that need to be revealed later in the movie. Then along comes Sissy Spacek. So it becomes even more of a family affair. It is sweet nature. It's very honest if you can get past the casting tricks.
Yeah.
There's something comforting about this movie, although it features the plot complexities of an episode of Friends, it still somehow seems to work. I mean, it's very subtle, extremely conventional. It's not terrible, But is there really a reason to run out and watch this film?
Okay, Katie, what did you think?
Yeah, it's funny. The way that Sean felt about The Fablemans is sort of how I feel about this. I'm like, there's no tension. Like, nothing happens in this movie. Like, why are we watching this? It does feel a little bit like they said, hey, let's get these actors together. You know, they're playing, you know, they're real life parent and child. They're playing parent and child. Like, wouldn't that be fun? But then there's like no script. It feels like every scene is like improvised because it kind of just happens and then they move on to the next scene. And it has very little structure and conflict that was pretty frustrating to me. You know, it was funny. I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, it's this small town. This guy goes back to take care of his dad. You know, she runs a bookshop. And I just couldn't stop thinking about what the Hallmark holiday version of this movie might be, because it has all of those tropes. Mm-hmm. And I think that version might be a little bit more entertaining.
I know. Why is it always the bookshop? That's always like a dead giveaway for treacly, corny moment.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. There's a lot of meet cutes that can happen in a bookshop.
I know. That happens all the time. What are you looking for? I don't know. Maybe I'm looking for you. Anyway,
exactly.
Sam and Kate playing now at the Lemley Town Center 5. Finally, dessert has arrived in our segment, the highly anticipated Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. It's here. It's in theaters. Sadly, of course, Chadwick Boseman is not in it. He died from colon cancer in 2020. But Letitia Wright and Angela Bassett are back, and here is a clip.
They have lost their protector. Now is our time to strike. Show them who we are.
Okay, Sean, this one was also written by and directed by Ryan Coogler. How do you rate this one as compared to the first? Does it live up?
Actually, I start off with, can you be both disappointed yet thrilled at the same time? That's the feeling I was left with. There was no way this was ever going to live up to the first one because the first one became this massive cultural phenomena. It literally blew the minds of millions of people around the world for the aesthetic that it brought to the big screen. It had never been seen before. It was a completely brand new experience. It's almost not fair.
Mm-hmm.
The biggest problem with Wakanda Forever is it actually felt like forever. It's actually presents pretty low stakes and it's somewhat underdeveloped. And it's an unexciting film in large chunks that played more like Aquaman meets Avatar. That said, the film works fine as a cinematic tribute. It's a nearly 3-hour long obituary to Chadwick Boseman, and that's where it elevates. I mean, the actual story and narrative, it's a little weak, and so is the plot. But thankfully, there's Angela Bassett, who delivers the best performance in the film. Oh my goodness, she's so strong. Even though she's not given a lot to do in the film, she could arguably deserve an Oscar nomination. Now, where this film excels is the craftsmanship, beyond exceptional. I mean, you can give Ruth Carter her second Oscar for costume design right now. The cinematography, art direction, visual effects, score, they're also phenomenal. But overall, Wakanda was just a much more magical and entertaining place the first time around. But then again, I've really never attended a fun funeral.
Oh, okay. Do we want to go to this funeral, Katie?
You know what? I liked Wakanda Forever. And I think that Sean is completely right in saying that the task that Ryan Coogler has with this sequel, when you have this sort of axis shifting hit in Black Panther and then your star passes away, like what do you do? So I do think that, like, you know, I think if people are going into this movie expecting it to be really like fun and like quippy, you know, that's not what they're gonna get. Like, it is a tribute to Chadwick Boseman. I mean, there were certain moments in my theater where like you could hear a pin drop because there were just these really you know, quiet, reverent moments, like paying tribute to him. At the same time, we are introducing the character of Namor, played by Tenoch Huerta, who's this amazing Mexican actor. And I don't want to be too thirsty on the radio, but he flies around in little shorts for the entire movie. I had fun with that.
Oh my gosh. Well, hopefully he'll be back just for you in the third
installment.
Fingers
crossed.
Also, we have new music from Rihanna because of this film. So
yeah,
that's a plus.
That's a good thing.
That's always a good thing. Although the song's not as good as the song from the first one.
Sean, you're such a bummer today. Okay.
I did not make this film. I did not write this film. I did not produce this film. I just watched it.
You're here to tell us the truth. Okay. Black Panther, Wakanda Forever in theaters, of course, in wide release. Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times and The Wrap. Boy, you two are very busy. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Madeline.
Thanks, Madeline.
Lift me up.
Coming up, not feeling turkey this Thanksgiving. Evan Kleinman is here with some alternatives next on Press Play.
Keep me close. Safe and sound.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentil?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Well, maybe you have heard that there is a turkey shortage right now. It's because of the avian flu. Millions have died, unfortunately. And economically, that means you will probably pay more for your turkey this year. So maybe you're thinking, maybe this is the year to skip the turkey. KCRW's Evan Kleinman is here to recommend some alternatives. Hi, Evan.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, how did the turkey become such a symbol of Thanksgiving?
Well, wild turkeys are native to the Americas. They were probably domesticated in Mexico, and then they went on this crazy round trip with the explorers to Europe. And then they came back with the pilgrims who are purported to have brought domesticated turkeys with them on the voyage. And most families were able to keep one or two. But I really think that Norman Rockwell painting has played a huge role in keeping the turkey on our Thanksgiving tables.
It's such a symbol of bounty. It's so huge. It seems to get bigger all the time. And so you do feel like you're a bit of a Scrooge, if you will, saying, I don't want to do a turkey. That is if you eat meat. But we're going to indulge that fantasy. What do you recommend as an alternative? Do you recommend another fowl?
So we did a shout out for good food for our Thanksgiving show, asking listeners to send us their questions. And it was surprising how many people asked us about duck. So duck is an interesting option. It's definitely, you know, festive, really rich, and not very hard to do.
Really? I'm kind of intimidated by duck.
Well, the thing about ducks is, you know, they're a waterfowl, so to keep themselves warm and to float, they're just covered in fat. Mm. And so the main thing about cooking a duck is you have to follow techniques that will ensure that all that fat renders and comes out of the duck as it bakes. But that fat is what makes the meat so rich. I have a link to, believe it or not, a Martha Stewart Duck Roasting 101 that is really good, just very straightforward. And she recommends a very just simple seasoning before you bake it, just pepper and salt, and then get crazy with the sauces.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I guess it's the fat that turns me off a little bit. I mean, it's delicious when I get it at a Chinese restaurant, for example, but just the idea of me cooking it is a little scary with all that fat.
But, you know, you can do that. You can order a duck from a good Chinese restaurant or deli who makes them all the time in advance and get a duck for Thanksgiving.
That's already cooked?
Yes, of course.
Oh my gosh. The clouds have parted. Okay. All right. So what if you want to buy one that's raw and you want to just try it yourself? Where would you go?
Well, most butchers who sell duck sell the Pekin variety. That's P-E-K-I-N with no G. Liberty Ducks, which you can access online because they're a farm, they probably have some of the best duck that you can buy in the U.S. It's a proprietary version of the Pekin. You can also get Mary's Pekin ducks from Gwen's. The restaurant has a butcher shop, which is really incredible, and the butchers there are amazingly helpful. And of course, both those options are humanely raised.
How do you feel about a turducken?
The idea of a turducken is so distressing to me.
Why?
I've never been able to eat one. It's just, I can get easily overwhelmed by richness. You know, my palate was formed on Italian food, very simple, clear flavors. I just think, pick one.
Not three. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so American. We have to have all of it.
All right. Well, I also think it's a big guy thing.
Yeah.
I think turducken was a guy. Let me stuff this and this and yeah.
Okay. So if you don't want to go down the poultry rabbit hole, to mix my metaphors, you have a recipe for prime rib roast. So that sounds fairly simple.
The first thing you want to do is you want to buy a bone-in roast because cooking with the bone always gives you more flavor. And then key to making it really delicious is to season it liberally with salt and pepper well in advance. And you can actually do this up to 4 days in advance. You're just going to season it, set it on a rack that's in a roasting dish so it can catch the juices, and let it sit uncovered in the refrigerator. And what that does is it will ensure a beautiful crust on the outside of the meat.
Sounds so good. And then do you roast it in the oven or on the grill?
I would do it in the oven because I would have no idea how to do it on the grill. Yeah. If you're going to do a steak, like prime rib, like cut already into steaks, then I would consider grilling it.
Okay. And you're not searing it first. You're just putting it right into the oven.
No, you're going to start it high and then move it to low.
All right. For vegetarians or vegans, people who don't want meat and have been completely turned off by our conversation so far, what do you recommend?
Well, these are both dishes that I have made many times, and I love both of them. Stuffed pumpkin and a butternut squash Wellington. Each of them have great center of the table appeal and are super delicious, and no one will feel like they're missing out. The Wellington, as much as it sounds, you take the butternut squash and you basically use it like you would a beef fillet in a beef Wellington. You cook it first, then you surround it with mushrooms and enrobe it in puff pastry that you can buy. So it's actually not very hard to do. And then the stuffed pumpkin, the one I really love is kind of like a strata, which is a savory bread pudding that you layer with cheeses and cream, and you can add greens. Now, if you're going vegan, you can just substitute almond milk or coconut milk for the cream and vegan cheeses, and it's just beautiful. You rub it with olive oil, you put it in your oven, and the bread pudding and the inside actually souffles up and comes and peeks out of the top a little bit. And then when you pull it out of the oven, it's just this burnished mahogany color. It's very impressive.
All right. So what if your family insists on turkey for Thanksgiving? So is there a way to do it without, you know, going the whole big bird route?
It's just so much easier to cook a turkey when it's been cut up into its parts, because you get it to cook much more evenly. It's less stressful. And if you feel you must have something that approaches sort of the look of whole bird, then spatchcock it, you know, have the butcher cut it down, the backbone, and open it up flat. You can put the stuffing underneath it. And it's a beautiful way to do it. And it's so easy.
It's not your Norman Rockwell image, but I think it's time to move beyond that.
We have to let that go. The only way that I feel like that is easier to do is if you're dealing with a bird that is no bigger than 16 pounds. So smaller bird.
Think small. I like it. Yeah. All right. Thank you for that permission to go outside the big bird. And what is on your show this week?
So this week, good food is from cookies to pie to baking without sugar. It is all baking all the time this Saturday on Good Food.
Oh, fantastic. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 10 on the radio or whenever and wherever you get your podcasts. Evan, thank you.
Thank you.
That'll do it for us for this week of Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great long weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you Monday.